welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. From the front page of today's Gazette, 2020, an unprecedented year. A pandemic kept us close to home. A quest for racial justice reverberated in our institutions, and a devastating derecho came from nowhere to rob us of our trees, our electricity, and our roofs. Meet some of the people who shaped our 2020 and who persevered. The first person, Bridget Williams Robinson. Need for Meals Endures Long After the Derecho by Allison Gowans of the Gazette. Bridget Williams Robinson and her husband, Javonte Robinson, didn't intend to start a nonprofit organization. Then the August 10th derecho tore through Cedar Rapids, and with the power out, the couple pulled out a grill Williams Robinson had for her business as a party planner and started cooking the food in their freezer for neighbors. Then they didn't stop. 4 months later, they still can be found most evenings under the 8th Avenue Southwest Bridge in Cedar Rapids, serving hundreds of free hot meals, no questions asked, to anyone in need. The need has not gone by the wayside, Williams Robinson said. As the weather got colder, they started a GoFundMe to try to buy a food truck or a trailer so they could keep serving in the cold, but couldn't find one they could afford. That didn't stop them from going out almost every day, despite the winter weather. I don't like the cold, and I don't want to stand out here, but I want to be loyal to the people who depend on us, she said. I'm praying someone will come along with a trailer or a food truck or something that's reasonably priced or they want to donate to us. On Wednesday, those prayers were answered when Good Morning America showed up with a brand new food trailer donated by eBay. I'm at a loss for words. I'm still processing, she told the Gazette shortly after the segment aired. It was definitely a shock. That thing is freaking awesome. Instead of moving on from the post-storm meals, Williams Robinson, 32, has expanded her efforts. She has applied for 501c3 status and named the effort Bridge Under the Bridge. She's partnered with HACAP to pass out free food boxes each Tuesday, typically serving about 150 people. Sometimes they run out and have to turn people away. People should not be denied food. There's a surplus of it in our nation, she said. Food security has been an issue people just don't talk about. People who want to help can message the couple on Facebook at Bridge Under the Bridge or call 319-804-9009. As for the rest of 2020, her kids, ages 15, 14, 12, 9-year-old twins, 3 and 2, have been doing virtual school. Everyone in the family is over the situation. I mean, I don't know whose idea this was to have a pandemic, but they should have thought twice, Williams Robinson said. It is awful, sincerely awful. The pandemic also has ground William Robinson's party planning business, Have a Blast Parties, to a halt. I wish I could be doing it right now, but I guess with COVID, nobody's throwing exclusive parties, she said. Let's be over with this in 2021 and everybody have a big party. Yet when she looks at the community's response to Bridge Under the Bridge, she feels hopeful. She organized a holiday toy and blanket drive and put a call on Facebook asking if people would sign up to adopt a family. It was amazing how people stepped up, she said. We helped 110 kids. I feel blessed. There's no words, no question, but blessed. Next, Neil Bennett. Iowa's first COVID-19 patient holds hope by Michaela Ram of the Gazette in Iowa City. The events leading to the beginning of the pandemic in Iowa might be a faint memory among the noteworthy occurrences over the past year, but for Neil Bennett, the effects of COVID-19 have been an inescapable reality since the beginning. In early March, he became the first patient admitted to an Iowa hospital with COVID-19. Though he has since left the hospital and returned home, the virus has left lasting impacts on the 74-year-old Iowa City resident, and as a result, he has watched with growing disappointment as some residents ignore public health recommendations and state officials refuse to implement stronger mitigation requirements. Based on my experience, I cannot understand why people have elected not to follow those simple measures, he said, referring to social distancing, wearing masks, washing hands, and other steps. Bennett, along with his wife, their daughter, and more than a dozen others, became infected with the novel coronavirus after traveling to Egypt in late February. Their cases were among the first in the state, reported just a week before the first instance of community spread was discovered by public health officials and marking the beginning of the pandemic in Iowa. He was admitted in early March to the intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics and placed on a ventilator soon after. Bennett, who stayed on the ventilator for several weeks, went on to spend about 5 months in healthcare facilities across eastern Iowa before he was finally discharged and sent home in early August. Bennett still undergoes physical therapy and pulmonary rehabilitation to build up the strength in his body and lungs, and because of the length of his hospital stay, he probably will continue this care for the foreseeable future. Bennett, who still relies on a cane and walker for mobility, acknowledges he sometimes becomes impatient with his progress and craves a sense of normalcy, even if it's just getting up on a ladder and changing a light bulb. Working toward recovery also has been an opportunity for reflection, Bennett said, particularly on his family and loved ones' experiences when doctors conveyed the seriousness of his condition. But he hasn't escaped the psychological impact this virus has had on patients. Sometimes I start to reflect back to the beginning, and it's easy to get emotional and think, I almost died, he said. His experience has not soured his appetite for international travel. The recent news of the COVID-19 vaccines developed has given Bennett hope his family could travel again in the near future. But until the vaccines help the country achieve herd immunity, Bennett hopes more people will take the virus seriously and practice every precaution as the country heads to the finish line of the pandemic. I just keep hanging on to the promise of the future to return to normal, he said. Next, Chelsea Montgomery Gusta. We have to fight for what's right. 8 months pregnant, she organized a protest in Iowa City, by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette. Chelsea Montgomery Gusta faced her fears not once but twice in 2020, all in a matter of weeks. The first was June 6, when Montgomery Gusta, 26, of Parnell, marched at a peaceful protest in Iowa City she organized with her husband, knowing protests have sometimes been met with violence and the couple and their unborn son could be at risk. The second time was June 22, when she delivered her son Calvin at home to ensure a natural birth without masks and avoid transmission of COVID-19. It was scary, Montgomery Gusta said of those experiences. It was scary getting up and going to the protest. It was scary giving birth at home by myself. It was scary bringing a son into this world. And so 2020 has taught Montgomery Gusta valuable lessons, to focus on positives rather than negatives, and to be confident in her decisions. We have to trust ourselves, she said. We have to trust our instincts. We have to fight for what's right, and we have to do tough things. Montgomery Gusta, who owns and operates Nalhart Kennels and Training Academy in Iowa City, said 2020 has been an awakening. There's nothing that teaches you more about yourself and the world than adversity, struggle, and conflict, she said. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew it was important to fight for things that are important. Next, Vaughn Strange, tackling big feats. We do it with others. UI dorm director fought injury and infection this year, by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. In 2020, Vaughn Strange oversaw the evacuation of thousands of students from University of Iowa residence halls as an unknown coronavirus blanketed the region with an invisible but deadly threat. As director of UI Housing and Dining, Strange waded through murky decisions in the days, weeks, and months that followed about refunds for students forced out early, wages for employees slighted an opportunity to work, and how to repopulate the campus's 10 halls safely in the fall or whether to attempt the feat at all. As it happened, Stange was honored in 2020 with an annual appointment as president of the Association of College and University Housing Officers International, tasking him, once the virus hit, with helping other campuses around the world tackle the same quagmire of concerns. We weren't unique when it came to housing operations and how we were being impacted, so we were trying to guide people through the association on how to respond. And then George Floyd was murdered, and there were a lot of racial concerns, Stange said, and a lot of that was occurring not only on my home campus, but campuses across the country. Somewhere between the abrupt spring exodus and the arduous fall return, the 59-year-old Stange caught COVID-19 himself, plaguing him with a stinging headache, the worst headache I've ever had, along with chills and nausea. His infection came just as he was presiding over an international virtual conference for the University Housing Association in mid-June. So I had people on backup in order to say, hey, if I'm down for the count, you're going to have to pick up some stuff, Stange said. In August, on the brink of bringing hordes of UI first-timers into a recalibrated residential system rife with new rules and unprecedented risks, Stange of Coralville fell off a ladder while cleaning up for the region's historic derecho just days earlier. I had to have surgery in September for a massively torn rotator cuff, which I'm still recovering from, he said. But when asked what he will remember most about this epic year, Stange doesn't dwell on the lowlights. Sending my youngest child off to college, he said about his daughter, Maureen, a freshman this year at the University of Northern Iowa. Although 2020 stole Stange's opportunity to visit Australia for the International Association's annual conference, landed him in more doctor's offices than he cared to visit, and compounded his job demands, he emerged with a sense of resolve. It just proves how adaptable we are as individuals and as a university and as a country, he said. It was a challenge, but we work through these challenges, and we don't do it alone. We do it with others. Next, Tamara Marcus, Advocates for Social Justice Ensures Demands Are Heard. There's still a lot of work to be done, CR activists said. By Kat Russell of the Gazette. Before becoming one of the frontline faces for the Black Lives Matter movement in Cedar Rapids, Tamara Marcus had been involved in only one protest before. Before this, I can't say I've been too involved in activism in the past, at least not in the police reform space, she said, but I've been in STEM for more than 10 years, and there's not a lot of diversity in science or academia, so I would say I've definitely been involved in advocating for increased access to higher education. So I think in the STEM spaces, I would definitely consider myself an activist. A former Fulbright Scholar, Switzer Fellow, NASA New Hampshire Space Grant Fellow, a National Center for Atmospheric Research Fellow, and a doctorate candidate in the Natural Resources and Earth System Sciences program at the University of New Hampshire, 28-year-old Marcus was named Linn County's first sustainability program manager as part of the county's plan to address climate change and environmental sustainability. But when George Floyd, a black 46-year-old Minnesota man, was killed by a white Minneapolis police officer and protests broke out across the country calling for police reform, Marcus said she felt called to get involved. I think I was just so tired of nothing changing, she said. I was tired of the shootings, of violence toward black bodies, and the world just continuing to go on as if there's nothing wrong. When Floyd was killed, Marcus said it seemed as if there was a noticeable lack of outrage among the public, as if the nation had become desensitized. But I think for most black people, there is no being desensitized to it, she said. Like every time you hear about another incident, you have to take space and process it, and you have to do that for every single one. And no one is doing anything about it. Elected officials, policymakers, the people who have the ability and power to make changes, they're not doing anything, or if they are, it's slow or insufficient, and we're literally talking about people's lives. Marcus didn't set out to become one of the frontline faces for the Cedar Rapids movement. She had been living in Australia and India and was preparing to head to Sweden when the pandemic hit, and she found herself returning home to Cedar Rapids. I guess it was just kind of a perfect storm of events, she said. Here I am in Cedar Rapids when these protests are breaking out across the country, and that's about when I met Nicole LeGrand Hoskins and Leslie Neely. The two were working together to organize one of the many protests over the summer in Cedar Rapids when Marcus became involved. We just clicked, she said. They had already started planning the event, and we were bouncing ideas back and forth and bringing more people in to get involved, and before we knew it, things had just exploded to the point where thousands of people were showing up to these protests. And from there, Advocates for Social Justice, a nonprofit advocacy organization that focused on police reform, voter engagement, and community needs, was born. I think we recognized what was an important opportunity it was to use this platform to push these issues front and center and beyond the protests, Marcus said. We wanted to put these issues before our local leaders and make it clear that something needed to be done. The three women began working closely with about 30 local leaders on dozens of reform pieces that they believed needed to happen in Cedar Rapids. That list was then whittled down to 7 demands, including the creation of a citizens review board for the police department, investment in diversity, equity, and inclusion, banning the use of police chokeholds, and decriminalizing marijuana offenses. The demands were presented June 6 to the city council, and the group set a deadline of 12 days for the council to agree. It was really inspiring to see the city council and the mayor go from kind of writing us off, at least it felt that way at times, to holding a special city council meeting on Juneteenth and unanimously approve our demands. In my opinion, this is democracy. You know, a grassroots organization organically comes together around one shared objective and goal and mobilizes and takes action to push elected officials to do the right thing. And that, for me, has been a huge bright spot this year. And though 2020 was packed with challenges, Marcus said it was also a year filled with lessons. I'd say one of the biggest lessons I learned was to be flexible and adaptable, she said. You know, we all plan the best we can, but you never really know what's going to happen. Things inevitably will come up and plans will change, and I think a lot of us have been learning how to be more flexible this year. Finding the good was another lesson Marcus has taken to heart. Since 2020 has been particularly difficult for everyone, Marcus said finding the positives has helped her keep perspective and stay away from getting sucked into negativity. Marcus said she was reminded of the importance of standing up for what you believe in and surrounding yourself with people who care about those things. And I hope we keep plugging away and I keep getting things done in 2021, she said. There's still a lot of work to be done. Next, Mitchell Levin. Wiping out web for weeks, derecho made world smaller. CR man finds bright spots despite internet nightmare, by John Stepp of the Gazette. As Mitchell Levin was writing an article upstairs in his Cedar Rapids home, he noticed the August sky darken. It was the beginning of a few minutes that changed the rest of his year. Then his house went dark. After that, a loud thud came from above as a tree pierced his roof. Right after his generator kicked in, he heard the crashing of his dining room windows blown out from the wind. While those few minutes made for probably the worst moment of 2020, something else made it even more problematic for Levin, a lack of internet for weeks. He was one of thousands of Cedar Rapidians to go an extended period without internet service after the August 10th derecho. At first he thought it wasn't such a problem. Mediacom service was not his top priority, because we had to get the tree literally out of the house, Levin said. But the roof was getting fixed. His internet wasn't. Dealing with Mediacom turned into a nightmare, he said. When things started to settle down, I realized the cavalry wasn't coming, that Mediacom didn't care. Levin, whose wife died in 2019, felt cut off from the world. He missed making 3 weeks of posts on his blog, This Day in Jewish History. He missed his monthly column that has run in an Israeli magazine since 2010, too. All of a sudden, the blog was gone and the column was gone, Levin said. When Deb died, one of the few things that gave you an anchor was doing this stuff. The world was much smaller. Eventually, he hired an electrician to fix his service. Mediacom still hasn't come to look at the line in his backyard. He's trying not to dwell too much on his derecho misfortune, though. Those are the dark moments, Levin said, but there have been other moments where people have been amazingly helpful. From the contractor fixing his roof to the staff at his doctor's office, Levin said people have been exceedingly kind. A group of friends coordinates trips to the grocery store so Levin doesn't risk contracting COVID-19 while shopping. I have some friends who, as I told my brother, are conspiring to keep me alive, Levin said. He didn't lose his sense of humor in the process during a challenging 2020. Somebody asked me, how do you know that it's a 30-year-old roof, Levin said. I'm 76 years old. Do you think I really worry about whether it's a 30-year-old roof? Next in Profiles of Eastern Iowans from the Gazette, Nikasa Bolumbu, your actions are what keep you going. Racial justice movement spurs Jefferson High School senior by Grace King of the Gazette. Jefferson High School of Cedar Rapids senior Nikasa Bolumbu was studying to compete last spring in the National Academic Decathlon in Alaska when the coronavirus sidelined her plans. Bolumbu, 18, joined Jefferson's academic decathlon team in fall 2019, determined to try new things after working through depression during her sophomore year of high school. The team won the state championship in March. Going to nationals in Alaska would have been her first time on an airplane. Instead, she watched 8 seasons of Game of Thrones. I was devastated, Bolumbu said. From there, I felt stagnant. As summer approached, Black Lives Matter protests gained momentum in Cedar Rapids, sparked by the May 25th killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. It inspired this revolutionist in me to see change and call for it to happen, Bolumbu said. She attended a protest later that month in downtown Cedar Rapids, where she stood on a park bench and spoke about police brutality. I wanted people to know you've got to keep loving, she said. You can't solve anything by hating back. Bolumbu also was inspired by peers at Kennedy High School, Rafa and Rama El-Sheikh, who spoke at a Cedar Rapids school board meeting during the summer. They called for anti-racism work in the school district. She joined Jefferson's Black Student Union, an organization working to build a community of Black students at all 4 Cedar Rapids high schools. In July, she got a job at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids Retirement Community, helping serve residents food and take care of other needs. 2 people at the nursing home I work with died from COVID-19, she said. I don't know how to process it. COVID-19 has come into my workplace, and that was scary, not knowing if I had coronavirus or not. Bolumbu was home August 10th when the derecho hit. When it passed, she found the roof of her house gone and the ceiling caving in some places. She and her family stayed in a hotel for a few weeks, but the insurance wouldn't pay for it forever. During repairs, a lot of the insulation had to be removed in the house, Bolumbu said. It's as cold as Antarctica, she said. She's been in online-only learning since Cedar Rapids schools reopened September 21st, learning from a bare-bones home, she said. She is planning to graduate high school in May. She wants to go into the medical field and is considering what college to attend. She worries about feeling lonely when she leaves home, but overall feels good about the future. I want to act. This summer with the pandemic, derecho, and protests, it taught me words will never be enough. Words can offer solace, comfort, and ignite a fire, but your actions are what keep you going. And Jessica Kelly, We Have to Stop Thinking of Ourselves Only, Healthcare Worker Lost Grandma to Virus, by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. For months, Jessica Kelly, 22, of Cedar Rapids, has worn a mask, kept socializing, and even lived in Mercy Medical Center, where she works as a telemetry monitor technician to reduce the risk of unknowingly spreading COVID-19 to family or friends. But other people weren't equally cautious, and Kelly's grandmother, Diana Dare of Fort Dodge, contracted the virus and died December 6th. As Kelly's family mourned the loss of a woman who might not tell you she loved you, but would show it in 100 different ways, Kelly saw messages in social media from people who did not think they should be forced to wear masks. The thing I take away the most is we have to stop thinking of ourselves only, Kelly said. So many people are getting hurt and dying and sick, and all these people want to say, it's all about me. We have to stop being so self-minded. As a telemetry monitor technician, Kelly's job is to watch heart monitors of patients in Mercy's intensive care unit and alert healthcare providers if a patient starts to have cardiac distress or irregular heart rhythms. In May, she was working on a COVID-19 floor, which meant heart monitors had to be sanitized more thoroughly and bagged for delivery to ICU patients. Mercy since has designated another floor for virus patients, Kelly said, so her work protocols changed somewhat. Kelly's big hope for 2021 is that most Americans will take the COVID-19 vaccine. I know there are a lot of anti-vaxxers and they don't want to do that, she said, but it's about protecting people who can't protect themselves. I hope that people listen more. Iowa virus cases fall as test sites close for holiday. With test Iowa sites closed Friday for Christmas, Iowa statewide is of 11 a.m. Saturday recorded a significant drop in positive COVID-19 cases from the day before, with 399 new cases. Friday's tabulation, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data analyzed by the Gazette, had shown 1,470 new cases. No additional deaths confirmed to be related to the coronavirus were listed by the state for the 24-hour period ending Saturday morning. A total of 3,744 Iowans have died from the virus this year. State numbers also showed a drop Saturday in new cases in Linn and Johnson counties, with Linn reporting 24 new cases, down from 74 on Friday morning's tally, and Johnson was 7, declining from 28 the day before. Adults in education occupations had only one new case, according to the state's numbers. 36 new cases were reported for children under the age of 18. The number of Iowans hospitalized with COVID-19 was listed at 558, which is down by 42 from the previous day. The number of patients in intensive care units also declined to 114, down by 7, and the same for those on ventilators, to 63, a drop of 6. Several long-term care facilities in the corridor still are listed as having outbreaks. Gardens of Cedar Rapids, 21 cases and 9 recovered. Lantern Park Specialty Care Coralville, 35 cases and 16 recovered. Methwick Health Center, Cedar Rapids, 30 cases and 20 recovered. Northbrook Manor Care Center, Cedar Rapids, 38 cases and 1 recovered. West Ridge Care Center, Cedar Rapids, 40 cases and 27 recovered. Willow Gardens Care Center, Marion, 73 cases and 61 recovered. The top 10 counties in total infections are reported by the state as of 11 a.m. Saturday. Polk, 40,414. Number 2, Linn, 16,319. Number 3, Scott, 13,764. Number 4, Blackhawk, 12,501. Number 5, Woodbury, 12,052. Number 6, Johnson, 10,790. Number 7, Dubuque, 10,429. Number 8, Pottawatomie, 8,065. Number 9, Story, 7,856. And number 10, Dallas, 7,707. Turning to the Insight page, we have the At Liberty column from Adam Sullivan, A Few Calamities and Some Bush Lights. It has been a year. Thank you, loyal reader, for being there through more than a few historic events in Iowa and around the world. It was a good year for bad stuff. Alcohol sales increased as Iowans stayed home. Gamblers found new appreciation for online betting, recently legalized here. And the long trudge toward drug legalization elsewhere gained major ground. As Iowa's self-appointed commentator on Vice, I often write columns in defense of perceived social ills such as booze, vapes, drugs, gambling, and sex work. There was a lot to say in 2020, and my adoring fans had plenty to stay back. Join me for a look back on a few of my most popular columns from this year, all connected by one particular light domestic beer, and a sampling of my favorite reader responses. The coronavirus pandemic hit Iowa in March, and the state government initially imposed significant restrictions on businesses and individuals. In tandem, Governor Kim Reynolds relaxed some regulations to soften the blow of the partial shutdown. I praise Reynolds for suspending the rules and allowing bars to sell alcoholic beverages to go. It was a smart way to bolster carryout business for struggling restaurants and give Iowans a safer way to get alcohol. As Iowa inches toward shutdown, let the liquor flow March 24th. A Catholic sister from Iowa City mistook that to mean I was encouraging alcohol abuse. She wrote in a letter to the editor, "If drinking is a good coping mechanism, Adam Sullivan, do you also recommend consuming drugs, engaging in vengeful behavior, and dominating others with violent sex?" For the record, I don't have any specific recommendations, just make sure your sex acts are consensual. I criticized the governor in September when she briefly entertained the idea of increasing the drinking age in hopes of stopping COVID-19 spread between young adults going to bars. This was the same governor who made personal responsibility her pandemic slogan and who shies away from public health measures that are difficult to enforce. Governor Reynolds can pry this bush light from my cold, dead hand, September 3rd. The algorithms and users of the internet liked the headline, borrowing a slogan from the gun rights movement. It turned out to be my most read column in 3 years at the Gazette. It drew a lot of responses, including this impassioned yet constitutionally illiterate gem. Governor Kim Reynolds is not the president, only the president is in control of the entire state. I also wrote about a national campaign to boycott Anheuser-Busch, parent company of Bush and a longtime corporate sponsor of the Commission on Presidential Debates. Green and Libertarian Party supporters were protesting the exclusion of their candidates from the presidential debates. Bush Light Boycott, How Iowa's Favorite Beer Upholds the Two-Party System, September 17th. A follower of the Gazette's Facebook page had this cute response, spelling and grammar preserved. Adam is too much of a wimp, W-H-I-M-P, to drink a common beer. He's probably into those fancy, fruit-flavored seltzers that fits his hoi-polloi attitude. H-O-Y-P-A-L-O-Y. He apparently didn't read past the headline or anything else in my body of work on Iowa's favorite beer. I am not participating in this boycott, so I can join you in raising a can to the end of 2020. Next, we have Todd Dorman's 24-hour doorman column. A year of columns fades into rear view. People will sometimes write to praise or condemn a column I wrote weeks ago. I can barely recall it. The job is always about the next column, so the past can get fuzzy in a hurry. So looking back at a year of columns is even more difficult. I had to rely on data and metrics. Which columns did the most people read online? Turns out my best read columns tried to explain some of the decisions Governor Kim Reynolds made in response to the pandemic. The governor made a lot of decisions, but wasn't much for showing work. Some were questionable, others were irresponsible, and her calls were inescapably tied to the election year politics and Trumpian loyalty, more so than to public health concerns. Who was Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds listening to on COVID-19 was the headline in an April column when I detailed Reynolds' ties to large agricultural and business campaign donors who would want the state reopened even as the coronavirus spread. Advisors? Not exactly, I wrote, but throughout her time in office, when the governor picks the wants of large business and agriculture interests over the common good and the broader needs of Iowans, campaign contributions offer a window into her decision-making. They're the receipts for dirty water, injured workers no longer getting compensation, and piles of business tax breaks we can no longer afford. Among the Iowans hit hardest by the virus have been nursing home residents and meatpacking workers. I wrote in April that Iowa had been neglecting these vulnerable Iowans for years, cutting back on nursing home inspections and leaving workers at the mercy of plant owners. The thanks these workers get is our anger and derision, I wrote. The Steve Kings of the political world demagogue immigrants and refugees for political gain, comparing them to cattle, depicting them as drug mules, terrorists, and criminals. Denying them health care and other basic benefits has become a bedrock Republican litmus test. Well, at least we don't have Steve King to make us cringe anymore. In May, when the governor basically threw the state open in defiance of health guidelines, I wrote, "All Iowans are gamblers in Kim's COVID casino. But it's no guts, no glory at COVID casino. It's time to get back in the game. Big bucks and political power are on the table. Baby needs a new pair of shoes, and there still are plenty of ventilators for granny," I wrote. Sure, without more testing and tracing, we're flying in fog, perhaps on a casino owner's borrowed jet. But oh, what a rush. How will it all turn out? The suspense is killing us. In June, Reynolds, for a time, discontinued her regular televised COVID-19 briefings. It had the feel of a cliffhanger season finale. Iowans are still contracting the virus and dying. Other states have seen troubling case spikes. Some counties in Iowa also are seeing cases jump, but the briefings are fading to black, I wrote. We haven't been this uncertain about what comes next since Tony Soprano looked up toward the restaurant entrance. What came next in August was news that the governor, backed by an obscure provision approved by lawmakers, would force schools to hold at least half of core classes in person. Schools that wanted to switch to online if local virus conditions worsened had to jump through hoops to get state permission. So much for the last shredded remnants of local control. Why did the state have to take this over? Again, we're a testing ground for Trumpian reopening prescriptions. The active agreement is politics. If Reynolds had listened to public health experts from the beginning instead of embracing the president's erratic failed strategies, we'd be sending kids back to fully open schools, I wrote. Instead, we're back in the briefing room with the governor socially distant only from reality. But hey, it wasn't all about the pandemic. Another popular piece described the scene in my Marion precinct on caucus night. A misreading of rules by volunteers left supporters of Senator Elizabeth Warren one vote shy of viability. What followed was a mess. This is like a badly organized middle school assembly, Nate Harris said. As a young voter, this is very disappointing. Volunteers messed up, and their late efforts to pull Marion 5 out of the dumpster fire might have fared better if more people had waited to go from being caucus goers to home goers. By the time the problem was identified, too few Democrats remained in the gym for a replay call, I wrote. Little did we know that the problem at Marion 5 didn't amount to a hill of beans on that crazy train wreck of a caucus night. What will 2021 bring? Good question. Vaccines, crowded restaurants, and grocery shopping without that tinge of doom would be great. Bipartisanship, cooperation, and satisfied readers, perhaps. You forgot a word for 2020. Irrelevant. Toddy Dorman in the Gazette. Irrelevant, wrote one of my anonymous trolls this past week after my column on Words of the Year. Perfectly sums up your career, if that's what they call you. If that's what they call what you do, try harder, Toddy. Rest assured, Toddy will try harder in 2021. And the community letters, and also the editorial cartoon, which is once again from Joe Heller of Green Bay, Wisconsin. We are seeing a mail slot, the inside of a mail slot on someone's front door. And coming through the front door are several things. We have a utility bill, overdue, medical bill, third notice, car loan payment, payment due, an eviction notice, a late warning, a credit card bill is coming through the door, and the welcome mat that is underneath the door says $600 COVID relief check. The first letter is from Barbara Asman Stone of Grinnell. Use surplus for services, not new tax cuts. So now that Iowa has $305.5 million surplus, some think it's time for more tax reform. No, it's time to properly fund all the necessary services that grinchy pinch-penny politicians have cut back so as to allow tax breaks for the ridiculously wealthy. We need more nursing home inspectors, more people looking out for the welfare of foster children, more and better mental health services. We need to properly fund Meals on Wheels, which in my town has been cut back to 4 days a week, with the one paid employee generously working for free one of those days and no new clients accepted. We need more state troopers on I-80 so that people will drive more slowly when we get a little snow. We need more prison guards. We need more people to inspect CAFOs. We need more rangers to care for our state parks. Use that surplus. Barbara Asmonstone of Grinnell. Next, Rosemary Brown of Marion writes, Mask and Music Affect Hearing Impaired. As a person with a significant hearing loss, I would like to share my communication concerns. I need to lip read, and masks deny me of this. I am not advocating the removal of masks, but wish that those people who work at cash registers or who will be interacting with customers be supplied with shields that make lips visible. Also, and equally important, is the background music being played in most establishments. For those of us who are hearing impaired, it interferes drastically with those we wish to interact with. If music must be played, then tone it down, make it subtle in the background. I have a cochlear implant in one ear and wear a hearing aid in the other, yet I am rendered impotent when in communication under these circumstances. Rosemary Brown of Marion. Next, Bill Goodman of Anamosa writes, Reader is tired of the liberal bias. Concerning the Gazette editorial, The Jig is Up for the Iowa GOP, December 17th, the message is absolutely absurd. The race is not over. Even if Joe Biden is unduly inaugurated on January 20th, he will not be the legitimate POTUS. He was fraudulently elected, plain and simple, just as the vast majority of Americans believe. If you care to write an editorial about The Jig is Up, then write it about the Biden crime family. I once again call for you to stop the blatant bias and return to the days when journalism was alive and well. Tell the truth. Bill Goodman of Anamosa. Next, Steve Springer of Cedar Rapids writes, Let's not forget Davison's legacy. There are many caring people in the Cedar Rapids area doing a great job supporting those in need and showing off our Iowa nice. However, let us all never forget one who was working to help the community long before current events presented the opportunity. In 1997, Henry Davison refinanced his house so he could purchase a building in what is now Nubo, and the Henry Davison Youth Center joined the community. The center offered a structured place for local children to hang out after school, get a meal, use donated computers, play pool, or just interact. Henry offered meals to the entire community at Thanksgiving and Christmas with hams and turkeys for everyone as well as presents for all the children. Henry's Youth Center was the originator of the backpack program in Cedar Rapids. Today, there are many people reaching out to those in need and making us all proud of our city and community, but let us not forget how in 1997, Henry recognized the need to support the less fortunate and took that need on as his personal mission with no flood, derecho, or virus for motivation. If Henry were alive today, he would surely be a leader in our current and community efforts. He would do so not only because he would recognize an opportunity to help, but just because he was Henry and he would be very proud of all those in the community working together to help those in need. Steve Springer of Cedar Rapids. Next, Mike Makovec of Springville writes, A letter to Grassley, Ernst, and Hinson. I just received our Social Security statement for 2021. I see our income went up 1.6% for the cost of living increase, which is nice. I also note that our payment for Medicare insurance went up 1%, which is reasonable, and that our payment for Medicare prescription drugs went up 58%, which is not sustainable. Thus, we have a net decrease in Social Security income. Not a very encouraging report. That brings me to my dismay of our tax system. According to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has allowed billionaires in 2018 to pay less taxes than the working class in 2018. Also in 2018, 60-plus corporations paid no taxes and yet received tax rebates of $4.3 billion. That is pretty disgusting. The Republican idea of trickle-down economy has done nothing but make the rich richer and the middle class poorer. Can you tell me again exactly what you are doing for the middle class taxpayer? Mike Makovec of Springville. And finally, Anna Marie Markulis of Iowa City writes, Teachers should be a priority for vaccinations. After the medical professionals, medical colleagues, and support staff are vaccinated, teachers must be next in line. Teachers are essential to life support systems. Teachers should be vaccinated before those of us elders who are not institutionalized, i.e. folks over 65 years old. Anna Marie Markulis of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Feldudo, and we turn now to the obituaries. Laverne Gonneau, 92, of Anamosa, formerly of Central City, passed away on Thursday, December 24th at Pinnacon Place in Anamosa. A family visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. on Tuesday, December 29th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Burial will follow at Mount Clark Cemetery, Central City. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Steve Schmidt, 73, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, December 20th, at his home, family by his side. As per his wishes, Steve has been cremated and there will be no services held at this time. Ann Lawton of Jefferson, a private family graveside service for Ann Lawton, 61, will be held at Franklin Township Cemetery in Cooper, Iowa. Ann died on Wednesday, December 23rd. A public visitation without the family present will be on Monday, December 28th, at Sillinger Schroeder Funeral Home in Jefferson from noon to 6 p.m. Marvin William Baumgartner, 94, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, December 21st, at Northbrook Manor Care Center. Visitation will be from 1 to 2 p.m. Wednesday, December 30th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A private family service will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories with burial to follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people to be allowed into the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is required. Marjorie Murray, known as Jean, 90, a longtime resident of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on December 2nd at the home of her daughter in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The cause of death was due to complications of kidney failure. A private burial will be held at Cedar Memorial on January 2nd. A celebration of life will be held next summer when it is safe to gather with friends and family at Kenwood Park United Methodist Church. Allo Jean Guter, born Allo Jean Benkin, 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, December 22nd at Northbrook Manor Care Center. A private service conducted by Pastor Phil Jorgensen will be held for immediate family members at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A celebration of Allo's life will be scheduled for family and friends at a later date. Larry Hall, known as Halsey, 79, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, December 23rd. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, December 30th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Burial will be held at a later date at 16 Cemetery in rural Thornburg, Iowa. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Donald W. Stokes, 61, of Dyersville, passed away on Tuesday, December 22nd at his home in Dyersville. Private family memorial service for Don will be held Tuesday, December 29th at the Rife Funeral Home in Farley, Iowa, with the Reverend Michael Schuler presiding. A private burial will be held at Fairview Cemetery in Farley. Lester Hicks of Cedar Rapids passed away on December 22nd after a lengthy battle against kidney failure. He passed away peacefully, surrounded by his loved ones. To protect family and friends from potential COVID concerns, a service and celebration of his life will be held at a future date. Johnny Yurkovsky, 52, of Marion, passed away peacefully in his home Sunday, December 20th. No services will be held at this time due to COVID-19. George William Milligan, 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, December 24th at Mercy Hospital. Memorial service is 10 a.m. Monday, December 28th at Cedar Hills Community Church with Kent Lantos officiating. The service will be live-streamed from Cedar Hills Community Church. A private family burial will take place at Anderson Cemetery, Swisher, with military honors. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. at the church Sunday, December 27th. Robert Richard Beamer, known as Bob, age 84, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, December 21st. Services and visitation are private. Burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Jean Herman Dirks, 80, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, December 23rd at Mercy Medical Center. Per his wishes, he has been cremated. Craig Allen Schminke, Sr., 65, of Belle Plaine, passed away December 22nd in his home. A family viewing will take place December 30th, followed by a private service at Oak Hill Cemetery. Donald Joseph Michael, known as Joe, age 73, died unexpectedly Tuesday, December 22nd at Mercy Hospital. Visitation for family and friends will be Tuesday, December 29th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. Family committal services will be held. And Jean Marie Flynn, 74, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, December 20th. Services will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Turning to the sports page, girls basketball, bigger reason to play. While recovering from a stroke, victories for Cascade Sconza came away from the court by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Clench your left hand into a fist, now release. Simple, isn't it? For Mike Sconza, it's a chore. For weeks, it was an impossible task. As hard as I tried, I couldn't open my hand, he said. It was just clenched up. When I was finally able to get my fingers to move, it felt like a major accomplishment. The highly successful girls basketball coach at Cascade High School, Skanska, these days is earning major and minor victories at home and three times a week at physical and occupational therapy in Dubuque. Doctors expect him to make a full or nearly full recovery from a November 8th stroke, but it's going to take time, and the 43-year-old Skansa isn't full of patience anyway. "I'm just so weak," he said. "I have no clue when I'll have full use of my left arm. They say it could be a year or two. I'm hoping it's quicker than that." Still, in some way, Skansa feels fortunate. "The other day I was in the elevator at the hospital, and a lady came in. She said she was visiting her husband, a stroke victim, and he'll never speak again. So yeah, this sucks, but I know it could be a lot worse." In addition to his day job as a high school history teacher, Skansa has built Cascade into one of the state's most consistent winners in girls' basketball. And 16 years before this season, his record is 330-68. Eight of his last nine teams advanced to the state tournament, highlighted by a Class 2A championship in 2018. He was the 2017 Gazette Area Coach of the Year. This was going to be a transition year anyway. In addition to the challenges COVID-19 has generated, Skansa had four senior starters to replace from last year's team, which went 26-1 and reached the 2A state semifinals. The first day of practice was November 9th. Skansa felt fine when he went to bed about 11 p.m. November 7th. He woke up at 2 a.m. to use the bathroom, still fine. When he woke again at 6:15, he said, "I couldn't move. I thought right away it was a stroke." Angie Skansa, Mike's wife of nearly 20 years, called for an ambulance, and Skansa was transported to Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque. Skanska's fear, a stroke, was confirmed. The cause, a blood clot in the bottom of his brain. The effect, paralysis to the left side of his body. Later in the day, word of Skansa's condition began to spread throughout the Cascade administration. "I got a call that morning from the principal, just that the coach was in the hospital, and there wasn't a lot more information, just that it was very serious," athletics director Adam Kedley said. "It stopped me in my tracks." After we got the news, the coaches and administrators got together and made a plan for the season. Ernie Balabaugh, Skansa's veteran assistant, was named interim head coach, Ryan Altier the assistant. "Mike and I have always been yin and yang," said Balabaugh, 60. "He's all about that 2-3 zone and that toughness stuff. My comfort level is in the offensive part of the game and player development." The next day, the first day of practice, a meeting with the team in Kedley's office was called. "Sunday, nobody really knew what was going on," senior Faith Bauer said. "We just knew coach couldn't be at practice for a while." Monday morning, we got called into the office, and Kedley and Altier told us he had suffered a stroke. We hadn't known how severe it was. A lot of us were crying. They weren't the only ones. "If you know me, you know I'm very private," Skansa said, "but I do show emotion in private, and I cried for 3 straight days." Skansa was transferred November 14th to Finley Hospital, also in Dubuque, then came home November 25th. "For 12 days, I couldn't have visitors," he said. "All there was the clock in front of me, and it sucked. It was hell." Meanwhile, Cascade opened its season November 24th with a win at Northeast. That was followed by 3 losses in 4 games, including a pair of last-second defeats against Bellevue. The Cougars were 2-3. "A lot of kids were learning new roles," Balabaugh said. "We have a lot of kids with some talent, but they just didn't have a lot of varsity experience. And they were accustomed to Skansa's tough love." "Skansa's a yeller," senior Sidney Weber said. "Ernie is more shy and quiet, more laid back." "Our styles are different," Balabaugh said. "Finally, I asked them what they wanted to see out of me, and they said, 'Hey, you've got to yell at us more.'" On December 11th, Cascade upset West Branch, then ranked number 1-2 in Class 2A, 54-51 in overtime. That ignited a 4-game winning streak. While Balabaugh and Altier have led the team in person, Skanska has worked from behind the scenes, watching film and helping formulate practice schedules and game plans. In-person conversations were replaced by group texts. "I talk to girls a little, to Ernie a lot," Skansa said. "Watching the games from home, it's tough. I miss it so much. It's brutal, but Ernie has done great, and they're playing hard. That's the Cascade way." "We're still Cascade basketball. We play hard every day," Bauer said. "Now we have a bigger reason to play. Skansa is a really important person to all of us. He's one of the most humble people I know. He hates the interviews and the hype and all that stuff. He's the kind of coach that just gets it done." The just get it done approach now goes into Skansa's recovery. He undergoes physical and occupation therapy 3 times a week at Mercy One. "My mind is in the right place," Skansa said. "I'm starting to make progress with my arm and leg." Much of his time at home is devoted to rest. The first week Skansa was home, he slept 15 hours per day. A voracious reader anyway, he has flown through books and Netflix series from the recliner in his sunroom. He is walking now with a cane, but he can't be unattended at home. Angie is his primary caregiver, mother-in-law Betty Kurt next in command. "I'm hoping I can be alone. I'm relying on everybody," Skansa said. "I had to learn to accept help, and I hate it." Skansa attended a practice last week, then was in attendance for the Cougars' home game Tuesday, a loss to West Liberty. "I think the girls had it in the back of their mind that he was a lot worse off than he is," Balabaugh said. "For them to see that he was up and around, I'm sure it made them feel a lot better." Skansa hopes to be back in the classroom for the start of the third trimester in March. Out of respect for Balabaugh and not wanting to be a distraction, Skansa doesn't plan to return to the bench until next season. "If they'll have me back," he said. "Of course they will. We're hoping he's ready for the first day of practice next year, Kedley said. We'd take him back tomorrow if we could, because we miss him. Quick note about the Iowa Hawkeyes, who will be playing in the Music City Bowl. They are playing Missouri, who is 5-5, and they're in the SEC, versus number 17 Iowa, 6-2 in the Big Ten, at Nissan Stadium in Nashville, Tennessee. That's going to be on Wednesday at 3 p.m. on ESPN on television. The line is Iowa by 14. Facts and figures. The Tigers just missed their second consecutive 6-win regular season, but are back in the postseason under first-year coach Eli Drinkwitz. The Hawkeyes have a 6-game winning streak that earned second place in the Big Ten West Division. Iowa's defense ranked third in the conference in points allowed, 16.0. This is Missouri's first appearance in the Music City Bowl, 34th bowl appearance. The Tigers are 15-18 in bowls and fell 38-33 to Oklahoma State in the Liberty Bowl on December 31, 2018. They've lost their last two postseason appearances. This is Iowa's first appearance in the Music City Bowl, 34th bowl appearance overall. The Hawkeyes bring a 3-game postseason winning streak and are 17-15-1. Turning back to the Insight page, Hope for a Better Year. The Gazette asked community leaders in eastern Iowa to write short commentaries reflecting on 2020 and lessons they hope we carry forward. The first is from Tamara Marcus, Sustainability Program Manager for Linn County. Community is ready to act on climate change. One of the most important lessons 2020 has taught us is the importance of giving a damn about one another. We are asked to keep one another safe by masking up, to show up in the struggle for racial justice, and to work together to respond to the devastation of the derecho. No one could have predicted the events of this year, and they challenged all of us in new and often painful ways, but we made it through, and that is truly something to celebrate. Let this year be a testament to the strength of us as individuals, but more importantly, a reminder of the power of community in the face of adversity. We will be presented with new climate adaptation challenges and opportunities in the coming years. My New Year's resolution for the community is to make good on the goals outlined in the 2020 climate resolution. Community-driven climate adaptation resiliency building is at the core of the resolution. I have the privilege in 2021 to communicate the progress of these goals through the regular columns here, and I humbly request those within Linn County to share your vision for a more sustainable and equitable community with me. That was Tamara Marcus, Sustainability Program Manager for Linn County. You can email her at Tamara, T-A-M-A-R-A, dot Marcus, M-A-R-C-U-S, at LynnCounty.org. The next is from Shannon Ramsey, founding president of Trees Forever. Rebuilding and replanting after a tough year. The memories of 2020 will never leave us. We've shouldered unbearable loss of family members and so many of our trees, leaving us with a lot to reflect upon as we are greeted by 2021. As we continue to rebuild homes, put on new roofs, and clean up debris, the reality of loss is with us every day. But we are resilient and are rebuilding homes, putting on new roofs, cleaning up, and planting new trees. That is really the point. We must keep going, improving our neighborhoods, and working together on solutions. That is the only way forward. We are driven by a vision for a better tomorrow, and in my case, a greener tomorrow, so that our grandkids and their kids have access to nature, clean air and water, shade, and outdoor spaces to play and gather. Putting a year like 2020 behind us is a challenge, but as Mother Teresa said, yesterday is gone, tomorrow has not yet come. We have only today. Let us begin. At Trees Forever, we begin by working together on a visionary plan to replant, and we keep planting as we plan. That was Shannon Ramsey, founding president of Trees Forever. Next, Brent C. Olson, in his last term as Linn County Supervisor after serving since 2009. Politics is about the art of the possible. Our American house is divided in 2020. Red team or blue, mask or maskless, shut down the community or open it all up, agree on the facts or create alternative facts. Tribalism rules the days of 2020, and I find it abhorrent. We are teaching our children that compromise is weak, moderation is verboten, and cooperation will get you blacklisted. My wish for 2021 and beyond is that local, state, and national leaders will find the courage to step forward and provide the public some visibility to a path of working with others in good faith. A path where moderation and cooperation are not vilified as surrendering to them. Politics and public service should be about the art of the possible, not the Machiavellian arts of destroying the opposition. The art of the possible must become the goal again. Americans, Iowans, Linn County residents working toward accomplishing tangible goals that move us forward to meet the moment. After all that we have been through in 2020, let us identify some goals and projects that we can be proud to champion and accomplish. I ask that God bless America and all of us Americans in 2021 endeavor. That was Brent C. Olson, who is in his last term as Linn County Supervisor. Next is Kara Briggs, farmer, an artist in Marion, pushed outdoors and staying there. The woods and water have always been my place of refuge and recharge. 2020 brought a critical need for both, and with it, an opportunity for me to expand my definition of fun. When the Y closed and I couldn't swim, I dug out my oldest, heaviest wetsuit and froze my butt off swimming in a frigid lake. It was glorious, and it fostered a new love of open water swimming that has helped buoy me through this year. When lockdown closed my favorite outdoor spot in Wisconsin, I found a new spot and a new love of hammock camping. This new spot is even farther from humanity, and the hammock is kinder to my middle-aged joints than sleeping on the ground. Here's the thing, it's easy to be lonely at home. It's really hard to be lonely in the woods. If 2020 pushed you outdoors, good, don't stop. The winter woods are spectacular. The stark beauty of trees in dazzling frost, crackling hoofsteps of deer, bickering bald eagles, and the immense silence at night are all good medicine. Bundle up and go find some new fun. Kara Briggs Farmer, an artist in Marion. Next, Steve Shriver, an organizer of the Loyal to Local campaign in Cedar Rapids. Reignite the Cedar Rapids vibe. We all know how tough 2020 was for our community, and I would rather not revisit the grim details. Rather, in forecasting 2021, I believe Cedar Rapids will have a new appreciation for our local restaurants, retail shops, and cultural venues. I see a rebirth on our horizon. It looks like this. We are greeted with wide smiles and open arms as we enter our locally curated spaces. We imbibe in the environment and succumb to the art, food, drink, entertainment, goods, most importantly, the local vibe, the Cedar Rapids vibe. Our local businesses and venues have learned how to be nimble, how to serve with limitations, how to deliver results during unpredictable times, how to better market their wares, and ultimately how to survive. Believe it or not, our community businesses have become something different, something better, a stronger version of themselves, if you will. Well, get ready, folks. You are part of something very special. By the summer of 2021, there will be so many great things going on in Cedar Rapids, it will be tough to choose. No matter what you choose, I hope to see you there. That was Steve Shriver, an organizer of the Loyal to Local campaign in Cedar Rapids. Next, Don Driscoll, Senate-elect of Iowa Senate District 38. Farmers know a few things about optimism. Like many, I look forward to 2020 coming to an end, putting a year of difficulty and challenge behind us, and starting the next year looking forward. As a lifelong farmer, I am always optimistic and always hopeful. In order to place a seed in the ground, to depend on factors completely out of your control for the crop to succeed, farmers have no choice but to be optimistic. This year was more challenging than anyone expected, yet Iowans handled each challenge and did so with smiles on our faces. In January, I will start my first term as a state senator for Benton, Iowa, and Poweshiek counties. I'm eager to begin this new role. I am confident we can find solutions to help not only those hit hard by the pandemic, but also help those still recovering from the derecho that tore through our state and the devastation it caused. I look forward to fighting for my constituents all across the district. For the farmers who face constant uncertainty, rural Iowans looking for affordable health care, and those who seek to support themselves and their families. Next, we have Brad Kunkel, Sheriff-elect of Johnson County. The coming new year will be a critical test for anyone serving in local government and elected office. The historic events of 2020 have transcended all social, economic, and political boundaries, and each of us has experienced our own unique impacts as well as shared experiences with our neighbors and community members. The test for local government will be how well we move forward under the shadow of national political discord, decreased local funding, and increased need for services. We will likely be asked to do more with less, and transparency will be critical. People trust and engage local government more because of the direct, tangible effects local government has on our day-to-day lives. It will be paramount for any of us in local office or serving in local government to be patient, thoughtful, and consistent as we navigate the fallout of the last 12 months. 2021 will be a year of recovery and reflection, of healing and enduring, of patience and progress. I'm optimistic that those of us entrusted with elected office, particularly at the local level, will step up to the challenges and live up to those expectations. That was Brad Kunkel, Sheriff-elect of Johnson County. Next, Stephanie Munsterson-Scriven, the Executive Director of the Cedar Rapids Civil Rights Commission, joined the effort to bolster equality. 2020 was a year of disruption and discord, and going into 2021, our community is positioned to make a transformative and meaningful change. We must be intentional about dismantling inequities and protecting civil and human rights, and we have a collective responsibility to create a welcoming and inclusive Cedar Rapids. The Cedar Rapids Civil Rights Commission has long worked to prevent and eliminate discrimination in our community, and this vital work will continue. We remain committed to a just, sustainable, and equitable Cedar Rapids. The Commission is here to serve our community, listen to our community, and respond to the needs of our community. We remain committed to our bold vision for Cedar Rapids. Together, let's create a community of belonging. We invite you to join us in this work. Next, Christina Bohannon, Representative-elect for Iowa's House District 85, seeking bipartisan agreement this session. As the 2021 session nears, Iowa legislators are setting out their different agendas for pulling the state through the pandemic. It may seem there is little Republicans and Democrats agree on, but protecting our people and growing the economy are not mutually exclusive. We can do both. Instead of giving hundreds of millions of dollars in tax credits to large corporations, we should invest in small business recovery and startups. Iowa-born small businesses generate 2 to 3 times more jobs over the long term than do corporations from outside the state. We should also use the tax revenue to invest in education, a proven driver of economic growth. We should crack down on wage theft and the misclassification of employees. These abuses deprive employees of their rightful pay and benefits. They also defraud the state out of tax revenue, increase the number of people needing public assistance, and constitute unfair competition against law-abiding businesses. Investing in child care and broadband, reducing the number of people in prisons for nonviolent offenses. These are all ways that we can shore up the economy while leveling the playing field for the most vulnerable among us. We can do both, and we must. That was Christina Bohannon, Representative-elect for Iowa District 85. And finally, Nicholas Abuwasali, the mayor of Marion. Let's build truly welcoming communities. What is your New Year's resolution? Look for the good in every situation and see the best in all people. How do you hope next year will be different from this one? I hope we will be able to safely return to doing the things we enjoy and more fully experience the things that make our community special. I hope that our economy will regain its pre-COVID momentum. I hope we will move past the divisiveness of this year, realizing that we can accomplish much more when we work together, respect and listen to each other, and find common ground on which to build. What did we learn in 2020 that we can carry forward? Adaptability and creativity are essential for success. The power of community is greater than any challenge facing us. Working together, we can achieve an equitable and just society and build truly welcoming communities where all people feel valued. That was Nicholas Abuwasali, the mayor of Marion. And that brings us to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, December 27, 2020. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. You can access our recordings anytime on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.